And it's good to see you again. So before we start with today's topic, do you have any questions about the cluster XY model or other things related to it, or any other question you want to ask? Okay, so I guess I will just proceed. Okay. So what we're going to talk about in these two lectures of today's and tomorrow's is a notion that has been under, you know, a lot of attention lately in current research, and that is also part of this wider topic of quantum matter, which is quantum complexity. And of course, quantum complexity has also another meaning that is very important in quantum computation, which has to do with the different complexity classes for computations that you can achieve depending on your resources, whether you perform your computation with a quantum computer or not. So this is not what we are referring to today. And so we want to make the case that there is something about quantum theory that calls for a notion of complexity, and we want to show why it's important and what this complexity could be. Okay, so let's start. Okay, so this talk is based on several works, and here you see some of it. And let me go ahead. Okay, so we spent some time in this course studying the foundations of statistical mechanics. And one of the questions that we had was, how is it possible to have equilibration and thermalization in spite of unitary evolution? And we know that one of the problems of unitary evolution is that it conserves the norm, and it conserves the entropy, and that does not allow, because of these reasons, for a wave function to equilibrate. And now we are tackling again this problem from another point of view, which is the point of view of irreversibility. So you see here that you have a picture in which we have a gas that is confined in a room, in a part of this box that is divided in two parts. And if we open up, if we make a hole in this wall that separates the two rooms of this box, then the gas will diffuse and eventually will reach the so-called equilibrium configuration, that is the one on the right. And we have the question, why does the gas prefer to be in equilibrium? Why that is the equilibrium configuration? And we know how this problem is actually very subtle already in classical physics. And one of the answers is, oh, there is more entropy in the right-hand side than in the left-hand side. So this is one of the things that we're used to say. And actually, first of all, what it means that you have more entropy is something that should be explained a bit better. But then you have the question, oh, why does the entropy increase? Why does it have to increase? Okay. And in quantum physics, we have a very similar problem. We know that with the unitarity, time reversal comes, and that entropy should be constant. But we have studied this. We have seen that entanglement entropy does not need to be constant. And but does it mean that if entropy, disentanglement entropy increasing, does it really mean irreversibility? So you see, this is another question. Okay, imagine we have an evolution which things get entangled, so the reduced density matrix gains entropy. Does it really mean that this is irreversible? So we would like to understand where irreversibility arises in quantum mechanics. And my first goal is to show that this feature of irreversibility is something that depends on quantum complexity. Okay? Okay, so let's try to define what quantum complexity is. So this notion has been approached recently in two ways. The first way is due to several authors, but the two main ones are Bennett and Susskind. And Bennett and Susskind define complexity in this way. So define a reference state. Okay, so there is one state that we start with that we consider a easy physical state. And then you have a bunch of resources that are elementary quantum operations. Okay, so imagine in the language that we learned, they are unitary operators with some local support. And you have a bunch of them that are, your resources. So these resources could be literally your resources as an experimenter, which means, you know, the unitary operations that you can actually realize in a lab, or it could be what nature can do. Nature would implement a unitary local operation by evolving with a term in a local Hamiltonian for a short time. So if you exponentiate a local Hamiltonian and you evolve for a very short time, then you know that we get a roughly local operator because of the Lieber-Robinson bounds. And this is a local unitary. Okay, so these are our elementary operations. And Susskind would say, okay, so a state, a quantum state, is complex relative to our fiducial state if the number of elementary operations that we need in order to reach the state, that state from our fiducial state, is very large. Okay? Do you have questions on this point? Is this clear? Okay. So in the Hilbert space, therefore, we have simple states, those that you can reach with just a few operations. And then you have complex states, those that require a lot of operations. And there are also the majority of states in the Hilbert space. So if your quantum evolution is ergodic, means that there are no obstructions in slowly reaching out all the corners of the Hilbert space, eventually, in infinite time, you will reach all the complex states. And then you can say, oh, you know, the likelihood that you are in a very complex state is overwhelming. And therefore, when you do your averages, like average entanglement or average something else, you find the same predictions of the Haar measure. Haar measure is the measure on this ensemble of all quantum states. And if you have infinite time, you can reach out and an ergodic evolution, you can reach out all the states, and then the time average can be exchanged with ensemble average. So all the calculations that we did in some lectures ago, have this physical interpretation, that they are actually the states that get most visited. So you will recognize this point of view as a Gibbs point of view for statistical mechanics. Now, we already commented a few lectures ago about one of the shortcomings of this approach, which is it does require infinite time, exactly because you need to reach all the states in the Hilbert space. Most of them are very complex. You need many operations. You need infinite time to do that in order to recover the hard measure. And, you know, this is not very satisfactory because, as we have commented a couple of times, phenomena like thermalization and the ensuing irreversibility actually happen not only in a finite, but in a short time. That's why we're so aware of them. So maybe we need a different approach in quantum complexity, and which is what we will take in this lecture. And it is the following. So we will say that a state is complex if it belongs to a large equivalence class. So we will define some relation of equivalence between quantum states. And if so that the Hilbert space or the ensemble of quantum states splits in different equivalence classes, and we say the larger is this equivalence class, the more complex is the state. Okay? So imagine, for instance, that this equivalence class is something like states that macroscopically look alike. Okay? So you, if you go back to the image that we started with, the picture that we started with, you can see that you have a huge equivalence class of states in which the gas is confined to one chamber of the box, because, you know, you can shuffle all the particles in that chamber, and each of those microscopic configuration is macroscopically equivalent for some notion of macroscopic. Right? But so right now, let's be vague. Even just looking at it, they look alike, right? If I shuffle those particles inside one chamber. And of course, I can do it also with the image on the right-hand side. And there are many more microscopic configurations that look alike if I can fill both chambers, right? So you have one complexity, one equivalence class that is much larger than the other. And this is what I would call a more complex state. It's a state that belongs to a larger equivalence class. So you can immediately recognize that this is Boltzmann point of view in statistical mechanics. When Boltzmann talks about entropy, and he's talking about the logarithm of the number of configurations, right? Log W. This W for Boltzmann is the number of microscopic configurations that are equivalent, that are macroscopically equivalent. So you see, in Boltzmann's point of view, in order to be in a state of greater entropy, you just need to count how many configurations there are out there that are equivalent. This has nothing to do with the fact that you go through those configurations. This is, you don't need to be ergodic. It's a completely different point of view from that of Gibbs. So this is what we're gonna use in this lecture. So What we will do is the following. We, let me see. Okay. So we will take our elementary quantum operations and we will apply them to some fiducial state. And then we will find a way of counting how many configurations are equivalent to this one. Okay, so here is the definition in this slide. So first of all, we are used by now from what we said in the previous lectures to call an equivalence class of quantum states, we call it a phase. Remember, this is what a quantum phase is. And the equivalence relation is this. If two states can be connected by finite depth quantum circuit, then they're equivalent. Okay. And now we will see how we can classify quantum phases by this definition. Do you have questions? Okay. So in this picture, figure A, you see a finite depth quantum circuit. So how does it work? So look at the figure starting from the bottom. Every wire in this figure represents, say, for instance, a two-level system or a qubit. Then you can apply unitary operators on all of them. So you see you have a global unitary operator, which is the tensor product in this figure of four local unitary operators, each of which does involve four qubits. So this one layer is a quantum circuit of depth one. Then you can add another layer. So you look above this layer and you see another layer of these local unitaries, and then another layer and another layer. So this quantum circuit shown in picture is a quantum circuit of depth four. As you can see, the action that you have on those four qubits that are pictured in green at the first layer, which is a time one, every layer is a clock, is a click of the clock, is a tick of the clock. So at time one, we are only involving four qubits with that operation. But at time two, we are now involving eight qubits that do feel the action of the previous unitary. You see, because in the next layer of unitaries, there are two qubits on the left and two qubits on the right that feel the action of what we did previously. And at the next layer, now there are 12 and so on and so forth. And as you can see, that local operation spreads with the light cone locally. You see, this is another way of seeing how local operations spread. Okay, so if you remember when we were classifying quantum phases, we were thinking of ground states of Hamiltonians, and we were having Hamiltonians that would depend on some parameters. And for instance, we saw that if we have a Hamiltonian that has a certain symmetry, then the ground states can enjoy the same symmetry or break it, and this would split the phase in two subphases, right? So you see that you could have different phases that were induced by the fact that your Hamiltonian had a symmetry. Asymmetry is a constraint. Now we are trying to do the same thing, but we are using a quantum circuit model. So instead of Hamiltonians, we are connecting states, not adiabatically by deforming the Hamiltonian, looking for the new ground state, but by evolving states with local unitary operators, with a finite depth quantum circuit. So my question is the following. So first of all, the first question is really a zero question. Imagine that you have no restriction whatsoever in the unitary that you can build. Then how many phases do you think you would have? So you have to help me with this question. You have to answer me.
Only one phase?
Very good. Only one phase. Yes, because every two states in the Hilbert space are connected by some unitary. So if I make no restriction whatsoever, then all the states can be connected. And so there is only one phase. There is only, they are all equivalent. Now, let's start putting restrictions. Imagine that now the only restriction that we make is that the unitaries are local and we use a circuit of finite depth. Okay? Like the one in the picture. Then at this point, not all the states will be equivalent and we would have different equivalent classes. The question is, what are these different equivalent classes? So, because there is no symmetry involved here, the only possibility is that this is a topological phase. This is indeed the case. If remember, this is what we learned in the past lectures. If you disregard the symmetry and the only constraint you have is locality, then a phase is a topological phase. And different phases means they have a different topological character. Okay, so I'm just repeating something that we did, but translating it in the language of quantum circuits. If we further constrain the gates to have a specific symmetry, the phase diagram will split in phases with different patterns of symmetry breaking, as we know. Okay? So we have the same picture that we had before. I only translated it in the language of quantum circuits. So far, so good. So we see that in order to define meaningfully equivalence classes, we need to define some constraint on the type of unitary operations that I'm calling gates that we use. So for instance, one constraint can be, oh, they should be local. Another constraint could be, oh no, they must have this symmetry. Now, there is another notion that I want to bring forward, which is that of Clifford gates. So what are Clifford gates? Clifford gates are unitary operations that belong to a proper subgroup of the unitary group called Clifford group. This Clifford group is extremely interesting because it corresponds to something that in some sense is not very quantum. Let me explain what I mean. This is a subgroup of the unitary group and it is acting on quantum states. So it does map quantum states in other quantum states. It does produce entanglement and these are all quantum features. So there is no question that these are quantum states. However, they can be efficiently simulated by a classical computer. So if we have an evolution that is performed by only Clifford gates, there is an encoding of this evolution that can be simulated in an efficient way in a classical computer. So the fact that you can map a quantum evolution in a classical evolution tells you that their quantumness is not really essential, because I can replace it. At the same time, these gates are those that are more easily realizable in the lab. They are easy to make, we have good control on them, we make very little error on them. If we only had to do Clifford gates, we probably would have a quantum computer by now. It comes to no surprise that being this a proper subgroup of the unitary group, which does, you know, can be simulated classically, it should come to no surprise that these gates are not universal. By universal, it means we cannot reach any quantum state in the Hilbert space by a quantum circuit made of Clifford gates. Okay? So, because of this, because they have this low quantumness, I will consider the usage of the resources that are Clifford gates free. So you can easily build a circuit with as many Clifford gates you want. And therefore you define a complexity class that are those states, sorry, an equivalence class, those states that can be connected starting from a fiducial state by means of a Clifford circuit. Okay? This equivalence class is much smaller than the one that you can reach with universal gates, because that is the whole Hilbert space. It's huge. Whereas the states that you can reach with just Clifford gates is a much smaller, it's an exponentially smaller set of states. Okay? Do you have questions? Okay, so let me repeat our definition. We start from some initial state. Imagine all spins up, or a state that is a product state. It's an easy state that can be prepared. And then you evolve it by means of a quantum circuit that only contains Clifford gates. And all the states that you can obtain as an output are considered equivalent. Now, this equivalence, this set of states that we consider equivalent, this phase is much smaller than the one that you can reach with the universal resources that are any unitary operator. So according to my definition, it's much less complex. And I want to show you that some notion of irreversibility does arise as a transition in complexity. Okay. Let me see. Okay. So I will show that as we change from Clifford to universal resources, many things show a greater complexity, degree of complexity. One is complexity of entanglement, which has to do with irreversibility. And then we have other notions that I will define the notion of T-design. This is a notion that is very important for scrambling and quantum chaos that are notions that we will explore tomorrow. And then I'll also say something about machine learning and simulability. Okay. So let me explain what are our resources. So these are the gates that we are allowed to use in our quantum circuit. So here they're defined. I'm sure you know them from your courses in quantum information. The NOT gate is the spin flip. So it flips 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. The Adamard gate is another 1-qubit gate that produces superpositions. And the phase gate just adds a phase depending on your input. So no phase for 0. And a given phase e to the I delta for 1. And we will only consider two types of phases, pi over 4 and pi over 2. And we call these gates T and S. And then finally, we have a 2-qubit gate called control NOT, whose action on a basis is the one you see. The control NOT gate is the only one that is capable of producing entanglement when it acts on, it doesn't produce entanglement on every state, like in this case, on the basis states, on the states in the computational basis will not produce entanglement, but it can produce entanglement when acting on other 2-qubit states, okay? It's the only one that can. So, now, the Clifford group is the group generated by the states H, S, and C naught. By generated, I mean that if I take an arbitrary number of H, S, and C naught, I can get a gate that is dense, an ensemble of gates that are dense in the whole Clifford group. So I can approximate as well as I want any gate in the Clifford group. Okay, so let's look at this complexity of entanglement first. So I will say that states are complex if their entanglement is complex. And this means that if I only look at entanglement, states, there are many, many states that have a similar entanglement. So this is our macroscopic observation. So if we have states that have a very similar entanglement with each other, we clump them together in the same equivalence class. And I will show that as a result, if a state has very complex entanglement, it becomes difficult to disentangle it. And we will define irreversibility using this notion. Okay. So what we're gonna do is the following protocol. We start with a system of M spins 1/2, and the initial state is a product state. So it is a state that has no entanglement whatsoever because it's a product state of n qubits. No matter how you slice it, no matter how you make a bipartition in this tensor product structure, this is a completely factorized state which will have zero entanglement. Then we start drawing some random gates between random qubits and we apply them. We read out the state and we compute the entanglement in a given bipartition. And we look at it. We look at how entanglement evolves. So we start from zero entanglement. We should expect that entanglement starts going up. And then maybe at some point reaches some maximal, saturates to a maximum value and doesn't increase any longer because it has reached the maximum. Okay? And then we try to reverse this evolution, okay? We try to see if it's possible with the same resources to go back. We will call the first process, the one in which entanglement is going up, we call it entanglement heating. And the one in which we are trying to revert the evolution, go back to the initial state, we will try to call it, we will call it entanglement cooling. Okay? Okay. So here, let me show you what happens with entanglement heating for three sets of gates. So the first figure on the left is obtained by using circuits that are made of Hadamard, Sinot, and S. This one is the Clifford group, and we know it's not universal. So we only reach a tiny fraction of states in the Hilbert space by means of these kind of quantum circuits. The second figure is the evolution of entanglement by using H, C naught, and naught. This is also not universal, but it is not even the Clifford group. It's something even weaker. And finally, we have H, C naught, and T. Remember, T is the phase gate with phase pi over 4. And this is universal. So a quantum circuit with this kind of gates can produce any state you want eventually. Okay. So what we show here is how entanglement on average is produced by a random quantum circuit. On average means that we apply many, many, many quantum circuits, and we average the result. And the result is the entanglement, but we also average over all the possible bipartitions. So we break the state in A and B part in all possible ways, and we compute the entanglement for that bipartition, we compute the average entanglement. Okay, on the x-axis, you see the number of gates that we're using. On the y-axis, you see the average entanglement. Okay, so you see that as we increase the number of gates, entanglement goes up and then stabilizes to a value that is pretty much the maximum possible value, and then doesn't change anymore. And if you look, the three plots are pretty much the same. So no matter whether I'm a universal or not, all these kinds of evolutions are very good at entangling. So you see, the fact that you produce a lot of entropy doesn't mean that you are using, that you have very complex states. The states in the, that are reached by the Clifford gates live in a very small equivalence class, so they're not very complex, but they have the same entanglement evolution than the states that are universal. Okay, so this is already a point that is very important, that if you quantify entanglement by using one of the Rényi entropies, this figure of merit is kind of blind with respect to the complexity of your quantum evolution. You have very simple evolutions that explore a very tiny fraction of the Hilbert space, which are very good at entangling. Okay. So now imagine we are arrived at the final state, our 500 gates, like in this picture, and we ask, can we try to go back, to revert this evolution? There is a sense in which this question has a trivial answer. Can you help me and tell me in what way I could trivially revert this evolution? Yeah,
reverse the quantum circuit?
Yes. So we have applied 500 gates, and now you apply them in reverse order with the dagger. And right, so you basically apply the dagger of the whole circuit, and then you go back. This is trivially true, right? Evolution is unitary, so I can always revert it. This, of course, would require the knowledge of the circuit, the perfect knowledge of the circuit. So because we are trying to look for an emergent notion of irreversibility, this means that irreversibility arises under certain conditions. For instance, we do not know what is the circuit. We need to look for it. All we have is the state. So the question is, it's a bit like when you have a knot. You are given the knot. I didn't show you how I made the knot. And you can look at the knot as much as you want. Can you untie it? If I can untie it, then I can go back. If I, using the resources that are physically available, effectively cannot untie it, then I cannot go back. So this is the notion of irreversibility that we are looking for. And when you're looking for something, there is a paradigmatic way of doing that, which is called gradient descent. So what we do is the so-called Metropolis algorithm. So we want to disentangle the state, okay? So what we do is that we apply a random gate, and we look at the entanglement, and we see if the entanglement across all the bipartitions went down or not. If it went down, I say, okay, this is a good gate, this is helping me. If it did go up, I will usually discard this gate, but actually sometimes I will also keep bad gates, only the probability by which I keep it is a Boltzmann probability, which means that if the entanglement went up a lot, the probability with which I keep it is very small. And then I keep going. Okay, so then I draw a second one and then a third one. So I'm looking for the descent in entanglement, and I'm looking for a path that takes me down. This is usually done when you want to actually cool the state, in the sense that you want to find the ground state for the energy. Here we're looking for the ground state of entanglement. This is our figure of merit. Is it clear what is that we are trying to do? So if this algorithm is able to find the way back, then we say that entanglement was not complex and that you have a reversibility. If we can't, if somehow this algorithm fails, it's unable to find the way back, then it means that the state was too complex. And I will comment on that later. Let's see what happens. Okay. So look just at the first row of these figures and let's see what's happening. On the left-hand side, we have an evolution obtained with the Clifford group, C0, H, and S gates. And this is not averaged on many realizations of the circuit, but we are just showing a sample one. In red, is the evolution from the initial state until we stop. So as you can see, the red curve is the entanglement is increasing and then it reaches a plateau. This is what happens after 500 gates, more or less. Then we start using our Metropolis algorithm and we look for a way back to disentangle it and go back to the initial state. And as you can see, it works very well. The Metropolis algorithm is able to find a circuit that completely disentangles the state in all the possible bipartitions so that we go back to a completely factorized state. And then from there, it's very easy to go to the initial state. So you see, evolution by Clifford circuits is reversible. Even when you do not know the circuit, you can learn what is the circuit. So I'm using this word on purpose, learning, because it has to do with other questions like machine learning. Yes?
But how is it a good definition of reversibility if it depends on the efficiency of our algorithm?
Yes. So this algorithm is an entropy pump. So what it's doing is trying to pump entropy out of the system. And if it is able to pump entropy out of the system, then we can actually go back. Okay. But now let's look at the right-hand side. And this is an evolution done with a universal circuit. And by the way, this just means that instead of the S gate, you use the T gate. The T gate is not in the Clifford group. And as you can see, the heating looks exactly qualitatively the same, right? It goes up and then saturates. And then we start using our algorithm. And if you can see, if you look closely, those lines are not exactly flat. There is some very tiny fluctuations wiggling, but we never go back down. Of course, if we run this algorithm long enough, because this is a finite system, eventually one of our trial will be the exact quantum circuit Dagert, right? But this is exhaustive search. When you have, you know, already 14 qubits, it actually never happens. In fact, it never happened. We don't see it. So imagine for 100 qubits or 1,000 qubits or 10 to the 23 qubits. Nature or whoever has these resources and is trying to pump entropy out will fail. So you see, there is no way of reverting the evolution unless you are told what the circuit is. So it's irreversible. Okay. Now there is something very interesting, which is the following. If this feature of complexity is really about the complexity of the entanglement. Okay, I'll stop. Yes, what is your question?
Yeah, so I wanted to ask if let's assume that there was a way that we could find out what the unitary evolution is so that we found the dagger of it, then would we say that our operation is no longer irreversible?
Right. I define reversible by actually being able to revert it.
Yeah.
And there is a sense in which this is always trivially true because evolution is unitary. You just apply the inverse circuit.
Yeah.
But the point is not so much how many operations I have to do. If I know the circuit, this is cheating. Somehow you need to, knowing what to do is part of the complexity. So you have to look for it. And so this is more or less the Boltzmann point of view. If you have to look for it, and there are many states around that look exactly the same, you will never find it. That's why that equivalence class is very large. So one thing that you could complain is, okay, there is something complex here going on, but why it's the complexity of entanglement? If it is the complexity of entanglement, I should be able to look at some feature of entanglement, some mathematical thing that you compute from entanglement, and being able to distinguish the two states. In fact, imagine that I just give you the two states that I have obtained from the first evolution at the end of the red curve and the second evolution at the end of the red curve. And I say, look at them. Can you recognize them? Well, what would you look at? Microscopically, they kind of look the same. Macroscopically, how do you know, for instance, without trying to disentangle it, would you be able to recognize where it's coming from? If it has been obtained by a Clifford circuit or from a universal circuit? See, this is a very important question. Is there something in the state that I can look at and say, oh my God, it's knotted in a way that I will not be able to unknot? So what we did is to look at the so-called entanglement spectrum. This is not a difficult notion. Remember that entanglement is about the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix, the spectrum of the reduced density matrix, right? So if you take all these eigenvalues and you plot the distribution of the gaps in this spectrum, you find what we plot in the second row here. For the states obtained with the Clifford group, you have a Poisson distribution. So you see, R is the size of a gap, and P of R is the probability of having such a gap in this spectrum. Look, as you can see, there is a high probability of having degeneracies, because the probability of R equals zero is going up. And then the probability of having large gaps is exponentially small. You may remember from our previous lectures that this is not what would happen if I can search universally all the possible quantum states. Remember, we know that degeneracies are rare, because any random perturbation would lift them. But this is okay, right? Because this is not the R measure. We are not looking among all the possible quantum states, because we were very constrained in our evolution by using Clifford gates. The Clifford circuits do not explore the whole Hilbert space. On the right-hand side, instead, you see the Wigner-Dyson distribution. The Wigner-Dyson distribution is the distribution that you would expect from a completely random matrix. And as you can see, the probability of having a degeneracy is zero. This is called level repulsion. So people have used these tools to understand the energy levels of random Hamiltonians since Wigner in the 50s to understand the spectra of heavy nuclei. You cannot solve the eigenvalue problem for a Hamiltonian with 100 particles, for instance. What he did was, okay, let's pretend it's like random. What do I get? And he got that, you know, there are no degeneracies. And actually, nobody thought of doing this with the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. But it's interesting that if you evolve with a universal circuit, you indeed obtain the universal results for these gaps, but with a Clifford circuit, you get Poisson. Okay, but now you see, now you have the answer. You see that we can recognize by just looking at the state where it was coming from. Yes.
What's the interpretation that we get this profile for using a S gate and a very different one for using T gate? What's the key difference?
So the key difference is that when you use the T gates, you are using a universal circuit. So this means that in principle, you can access all the states in the Hilbert space. And therefore, you expect that your results are those that you would obtain by taking a random matrix. And the distribution of the gaps of the eigenvalues of a random matrix is given by the Wigner distribution, which is a result in statistics. On the other hand, the Clifford group is not ergodic. We are not exploring all the states. So it may happen or may not happen that it samples the Hilbert space in an efficient way. And it doesn't. It does not from the point of view of entanglement. So this is what I mean. Yeah?
Just 5 minutes left.
Oh my God. All right, okay. Okay, so here you see the math of it. So this is just how we define these gaps R, and what is the probability of getting R, and what are the different surmises that we get for these distributions. Okay. So, okay, since I've only 5 minutes, I want to make some remarks and comments. So what is that we have done? We have defined a notion of complexity that has to do with how large is the class of states that are equivalent to some reference state. And so we see that the states that are equivalent to a factorized state, when you can use Clifford circuits, is a small class. And so this is known. Whereas the states that are equivalent when you can use a universal circuit is a very large class. This is also known. So I'm just declaring, I call this a second class more complex. But this does correspond to something, which is states that belong to the first class can be easily disentangled by Metropolis algorithm, which is just the search of a circuit that will disentangle it, whereas the other ones are not. And this has nothing to do with the fact that in order to make these states, we had to use many gates. We use 500 gates in both cases. The difference is that in the second case, these states have around many other states, much more than in the first case. And this is the quantum equivalent of Boltzmann point of view. They sit in a larger equivalence class. So it has nothing to do with the fact that you actually had to go through all the states in that class. So I hope I was able to show you this. Now let me show you one last thing. So I will start again from here tomorrow. So is the time over, Lauren?
You have 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay, so I only 2 minutes, so I will start from here tomorrow. I just want to show you a teaser image that I, you know, we'll go through this tomorrow, and it's this one. So remember when I asked you, oh, imagine that I actually give you the state and you look at it and you want to know whether it came from Clifford or from Universal. And actually you can do that. And this is a visual representation of the states that I will explain tomorrow. And on the left-hand side, you see states produced by random Clifford circuits. And on the right-hand side, you see states produced by random universal circuits. And you can actually, your brains are actually machine learners. So you, I think you're already learning the difference between these two. So I guess I, if I show you another plot of other states, you would be able to classify them as Clifford or as universal. So this has to do with, you know, machine learning of quantum states, and we will be talking about it tomorrow. Okay, so I think I can finish here, and I will take some questions. Okay, if there are no other questions, I guess we can finish, and I'll see you tomorrow.